Good morning. I thought I would give you a little bit of a taste of camp. It's coming up. And I'll give you one of the object lessons that I will be sharing at camp at Willowbrook with the teens this week. I guess we can get rid of this projector. There we go. You know, I think the best lessons that we teach are the lessons that we've learned in life. It's one thing to get into the Word of God and read about something and study it. It's another thing to have lived it and put it into practice. And I think that's where we really learn what the Word of God is all about and what God really can do for us. And this morning I want to talk about the concept of trust. Actually, Joe already mentioned it in his devotional. Talked about how important it is to trust the Lord. And it absolutely is. We read in Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, what? Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your path. Right? He will make your path straight.
You're going to force me to be recorded. No, that's fine. That's fine. You want me to hold it? Okay, it's going to be a little hard to maneuver around here, but that's okay because I'm going to take this thing off anyway. It's really, really heavy. In fact, let's see. Josiah, come on up here for a second. In fact, I'm going to get your dad to come and help you. See if you can put this on, or see if your dad can put it on. Don't fall over. You can stand up straight, can't you? Just don't fall over. Is it heavy? Not very much. It weighs more than you do, probably. No? Okay, you can wear it around for the rest of the day. How's that? Probably don't want to do that, huh? No, I guess not. Thank you, Josiah. You can just set it there. It's fine. I learned a lot of things in my flying experience, and a lot of them had to do with trusting the Lord. And I thought what I would do is share some of those with you and some of the ways that the Lord's Word has actually been brought home to me by the experiences that I've had in my flying. But in order to really understand it, you have to understand that the only thing I ever wanted to do was fly. In fact, when I met my wife in seventh grade, back in Bristol, Tennessee, at a Bible conference, we were together for a week, and of course, we were only in seventh grade, so, you know, how serious could it have been? But I said to her at the end of the week, I said, one day, I'm going to get in an airplane, I'm going to fly down to Atlanta to see you, because that's where she lived. And she said, oh, yeah, okay, right. But I actually did that one time, so that was kind of fun. But I found that sometimes the things that God leads us into, He leads us into in a way that we don't expect. And sometimes it's hard to trust Him to do His will instead of our will, and to do it His way instead of our way. The only thing I ever wanted to do was to fly. And in fact, my whole life was focused around that one objective when I was young. I went into engineering because in order to fly with the Air Force, you had to have a technical degree. I didn't care about engineering. I didn't want to be an engineer. I just wanted to fly. But if I wanted to fly, I had to have a technical degree, so I got an engineering degree. Went through college on an Air Force scholarship because I wanted to fly. Did everything I could. Worked hard in ROTC. Got to be the cadet corps commander for the college in ROTC because I wanted to fly. I took my flight physical. Everything came out great, except they got my medical records. And there was a problem with my medical records, because when I was young, about a year and a half, and I don't share this with too many people, but I developed a heart problem. And my folks were living in Canada at the time, and they took me into the doctors in Brantford at the Children's Hospital, and they said, your son has a thickening of the wall of the heart. And it's progressive, and it's going to get worse and worse until one day it will kill him. And we've never been able to observe it. We'd like you to come in every 2 weeks so we can do some EKGs and observe the process and at least learn from what's about to happen to him. And they said he's probably only got about 6 months or 8 months to live. Well, they took me in every 2 weeks, and it got to the point where the situation was worse and worse, and the doctors eventually said to my folks, the next time you bring him in, you're going to have to leave him because he's going to have a heart attack. And if he has it anywhere but here, there's nothing we can do for him. So the next scheduled time they were to bring me in, my dad being an evangelist who had traveled all across Canada, there were prayer meetings and assemblies all across Canada for me. And they took me in the next day, and the doctors did the EKG, and there was absolutely nothing wrong. Now, that caused a problem for me later on. Because the doctors had written on my medical records, fantastic, unbelievable, we don't understand this, you know, a miracle and all that. And then I got to the Air Force and I wanted to fly. And they got my medical records and they looked at these and said, we don't know what to do with this. And so they sent my medical records down to Brooks Air Force Base down in San Antonio. And they looked at them and they analyzed them and they sent them back. And I remember very clearly being called into the commandant's office. And he said, well, we got the response back from Brooks and here's your choice. Now, you have to realize that Vietnam was going on at this point, so if I wasn't able to fly, I would probably be serving in some capacity anyway. But they said, well, you have a choice. We can either classify you 4F, in which case you would not be eligible for the draft and you wouldn't have to serve at all, or we can just ignore the whole thing and let you fly. And I said, guess what? You know, I want to fly. It's all I ever wanted to do. So they ignored the whole thing, and I went to pilot training. Well, no, I didn't go to pilot training because when I was getting ready to graduate, Vietnam was winding down and all the pilots were coming home. And they were putting them all in stateside flying positions and they didn't have any empty cockpits for us. So I remember they called us all into a room, all of us who were getting ready to graduate, and they said, well, we have a problem. We have no cockpits for you, so there's no use sending you to pilot training if we don't have any place you can fly when you get out. So they said, we're going to give you a choice. You can either do 3 months as an engineer, or you can wait 2 years to go to pilot training, and then we'll schedule you to go to pilot training. And that was a big disappointment to me. You know, here I'd worked hard. I'd gotten good grades. I'd been the corps commander. I'd done everything I could to fly. And it seemed like everything was being yanked out from underneath me, and there wasn't anything I could do to go to pilot training. And I think that sometimes when we have something that we have set our hearts on, the Lord has to teach us that it's really not the most important thing. And we have this vision of something we want to do, and sometimes it takes the death of that vision before we can face whatever the Lord really has in store for us. And I remember clearly sitting down with Laura. We were engaged at the time, and I said, you know, I would love to fly. I would love to wait 2 years, but we have a wedding coming up, and everything's arranged. I think probably the wisest thing is maybe the Lord is just telling me to work as an engineer for the Air Force for 3 months and get out of my commitment. And that was a pretty good trade, a four-year education for 3 months in the Air Force. And so I went off to comm officer school, and I worked for 3 months as an engineer for the Air Force with the plans of getting out. And when I got out of the Air Force 3 months later, I went ahead and put an application in with the Georgia Air National Guard, which is where we were living at the time. And trusting the Lord that he was going to do whatever was best for us. And that's not an easy thing to do sometimes when everything you've ever wanted just came crashing down around your ears. But we trusted that the Lord was going to do whatever was best for us. That's what his word promises, right? He says, all things will work for good to them who love him, to them who are the called according to his purpose. So we kept claiming that verse, okay, that must be what he's going to do, whatever's best for us. And so I went to work as an engineer. I went to work for a company that you probably are aware of, although you probably never heard of the company. But if you ever went to school, you know those big yellow buses that have the little bird emblem on the side? Anybody? Yeah, Bluebird. Yeah, right. I went to work for Bluebird Bus Company. And Bluebird Bus Company is located in Fort Valley, Georgia, owned by two brothers whose last name was Luce, the Luce brothers. The Luce brothers were believers. And it turned out that the vice president of the company was a believer who attended the assembly down in Macon, Georgia. So when I took the job with Bluebird, we went down there, we moved down there, we started going to the assembly, got to know the folks down there. It was great. It was a good time. The Lord was teaching me a lot of things, teaching us a lot of things. We were newlyweds, so we were just kind of getting adjusted to each other and still trusting that the Lord was going to do whatever was best for us. We didn't know how that was going to happen or what that was going to do or... But we worked for Bluebird for about 3 years, and I had, when I had gone into the Air National Guard, just on a lark, I'd put my application in for pilot training with the Guard. But pilot training slots with the Air National Guard are all political. If you don't know somebody, they get so few of them that they would never get to somebody who wasn't connected politically or something. So there wasn't much chance that that was ever going to happen. But I remember sitting at my job, and getting a phone call from a sergeant at Dobbins Air Force Base just outside Atlanta. And I answered the phone and he said, we need to know how many thousand pounds of household goods you're shipping to Arizona next month. And I said, pardon me? Are you sure you have the right phone number? You have the right person? He said, well, this is Lieutenant Woodhouse, isn't it? I said, well, yeah. And he said, well, you're going to pilot training next month. Hasn't anybody told you? And I said, no, nobody told me. You know, it's kind of a surprise. Well, it turns out that there was a guy who was slated to take a pilot training slot with the Guard. And at the last minute, he got medically disqualified. And they didn't want to lose the slot. They said, we need somebody who's already had their physical, who's already an officer. We don't have time to send them to officer candidate school or anything like that. We need somebody right now. And they looked in the pile, and there was my application. And they said, send this guy. So this sergeant was calling me to tell me, or to find out how many thousand pounds he had to arrange to go to Arizona. Well, it turns out that the guy who was medically disqualified was a believer. And he got his medical disqualifications overturned, and he took the next pilot training slot they had. So he ended up going, too. So we got to know each other, got to be good friends. But that's the way the Lord works. You know, if you trust him, he may change the plans, he may change the timing, he may force you to rely on him and his judgment as to what's best, but in the end, he's going to do what's best for you. And he knew what my desires were. He just had a different time schedule than I had. And I didn't see his time schedule, I only knew mine. But the fact that I was willing to give up mine to do whatever he wanted, I think was the thing that he rewarded and ended up through a number of believers, and it's amazing how believers come into this, ended up having me go to pilot training. Well, pilot training is kind of unusual. Pilot training is 1 year in which you experience every emotion possible. Joy, fear, terror, anger, disappointment, everything in 1 year. It's an amazing year. It's a very hard year for the spouses because they have to go through all this vicariously as their husbands or wives are going through all this. But it's a very, very interesting year of training. And it starts off with academics. You start off in the books, and you learn aircraft systems, and you learn about flight dynamics, and you learn about weather, and all these things you have to learn in order to be able to fly. Before you ever set foot in an airplane, you're doing academics. And, you know, it's easy to sit and get discouraged and say, you know, I want to fly, and I'm not flying. I'm sitting here in a classroom for 2 or 3 months just studying. But you trust that's what the Lord wants you to do. And in the process of all that, you begin to learn some procedures that you're going to have to use, and you learn to trust your procedures. There's a set of procedures that we learn when you learn to fly an aircraft called the boldface procedures. And they're called boldface because in the manual, the flight manual, which is about that thick, there's one section that has emergency procedures, and these procedures are all in boldface. And you have to memorize them. And every time we got together on a weekend drill for the Guard, we would be tested on our boldface procedures. And you learn to trust your boldface procedures because there are certain things that can happen in an airplane and you don't have time to think about what you want to do. You have to react and you have to do the right thing and you have to do it immediately. And that's what those boldface procedures are all about. And there have been a couple of times in airplanes where those boldface procedures have made a big difference to me. But you learn to trust those procedures, to learn them well, and to say, this is a principle that I have to put into my life. And I have to be willing to trust it, even when things are falling apart. And so you memorize those boldface procedures. And when the tough times come, and they describe flying as hours and hours of boredom interrupted occasionally by moments of stark terror. And that's not too far off when you're flying a fighter, because if you're flying between here and the bombing range, you're just flying along, you know, and it's not all that interesting. But once you get to the bombing range, things get hectic in a hurry. And you'll be flying along, and all of a sudden you'll get an emergency light that says something's drastically wrong with your airplane. And it's those boldface procedures that are going to save you at that point. You have to trust that this thing I memorized is the thing I really need to do. And I think it's like that in life with as a Christian, because there are certain things we know are principles. We know what God approves of, what God doesn't approve of. We know what his standards are. And if we constantly keep them in mind and we say, no matter what happens, I am not going to violate this standard. I am not going to choose to go against this principle. You know, when temptation comes, I know what his word says. I'm going to do what's right. Then it's going to make a big impact in our lives. It's like those boldface procedures, you know. Oh, man, here's a temptation. And then up comes a verse. The boldface, you know, the verse that you memorize that applies in that very situation. And you say, that's what I'm going to do. That's what I have to do. So you learn to trust your procedures. And you learn all that during the academics before you even get into the airplane. If you don't know your bold face, they won't let you in the airplane because you wouldn't know what to do in the case of an emergency. So all those academics become critical. They're a precursor to the flying that you really want to do, but they're necessary. And you do a few other things before you get into the airplane. You learn how to jump out of an airplane. Now, I always thought that anybody who jumped out of a perfectly good airplane was insane to begin with. But they teach you how to do it for some strange reason. You know, if you have to eject, you have to know how to come down on the parachute. You have to know how to land on the ground so you don't injure yourself. And so you spend several weeks of jump training. And believe me, the first jump out of an airplane is not the hardest jump. It's the second jump that's the hardest jump. Because the first jump, you have no idea what to expect. The second jump, you know exactly what's coming. And it's a lot harder to step out of that airplane door the second time than the first time. And after that, it gets easier. But it's amazing that they take the time to teach you how to do what you hope you never have to do. Isn't that something? I never wanted to eject out of an airplane. Never had to, thank God. But they teach you how to do it, and they teach you what you have to do if that happens to you. And sometimes that's, again, like the Christian life. We have to trust something else. We have to trust something that God has placed there, realizing that it's there for our good. It's there for our protection. And we have to trust it. You know, a parachute is like that. I mean, this parachute right here won't save anybody. It's for training only, so it doesn't really deploy. But a parachute is something that you didn't pack it. I mean, as a fighter pilot, you don't pack your own chutes. They have, you know, guys who do that, enlisted guys who, that's their whole job is to pack parachutes. And every now and then they'll take one of the guys and they'll say, okay, you, grab that chute you just packed, come with me, put it on, we're going to go jump. And that guy will have to jump with his own parachute. Now, you think they pack them pretty well? Yeah, sure. They might have to jump with them themselves. But for you, as a pilot, you didn't pack the chute. You're trusting that somebody else did it right. You're trusting that that guy was conscientious when he packed that chute. He wasn't hungover. He wasn't thinking about his girlfriend. He was focusing on what he was doing. He packed that chute just the way it should have been packed. And you're going to trust that when you strap it on your back and go up to fly. I remember hearing a story of back when Nixon, boy, I'm dating myself, when Nixon was leaving office, that there was a flight on Air Force One, and Nixon was there, and then, of course, Ford was taking over, Gerald Ford, and Henry Kissinger, who was an advisor, was there, and Billy Graham, all on the same flight. And they're about halfway through the flight, and they get this announcement over the intercom. It says, we have just lost two of our four engines. We're going to have to ditch the airplane. We're going to have to jump out, but don't worry. There's four parachutes in the back, so just grab one of the parachutes, strap it on, jump out. You'll be fine. Well, President Nixon says, well, I've just finished being president. I've got to write my memoirs. The world needs to know what happened during my presidency, so I have to survive. So he grabs a parachute and he jumps out. And then Gerald Ford says, well, I'm the next president, and they're going to need me to handle the crises that are coming up. I've got to survive. So he grabs a parachute and he jumps out. About this time, this voice comes out of one of the closets, and this hippie comes out. And he's stowed away, and now there's a problem because there's only two parachutes left, but there's three people on board. You got Kissinger, Billy Graham, and this hippie. And Kissinger says, well, I'm the smartest man in the world, and I just solved the Middle East crisis, and they might need me again. I got to survive. So he grabs one, he bails out. And then Billy Graham's looking at the hippie, and he says, you know, son, I've lived a good long life. I've probably accomplished what the Lord wants me to accomplish. Why don't you take the last parachute? You jump out, and I'll go down with the airplane. And the hippie says, no sweat, Pops. He says, the smartest man in the world just bailed out with my knapsack. Now, no matter how much he believes in that knapsack, it's not going to help him at all on the way down, is it? It's not just a matter of how seriously you believe. It's all a matter of what you're believing in. What do you put your trust in? And we have to learn to put our trust in the Lord and in the Lord alone. He's the one who's going to sustain us, not anything else. It's not going to be our finances. It's not going to be our retirement. It's not going to be our health insurance. We put our trust in one thing, and that's in the Lord to do what he's going to do in our lives and know that that's going to be the best for us. And that's kind of what you do with a parachute. You put your trust in somebody else and their work. We did that in salvation, didn't we? We put our trust in somebody else's work, in the work of Jesus Christ when he died on the cross. And life is all full of that kind of trust in the Lord. It doesn't end at salvation. It only begins at salvation. So they teach us how to jump. teach us how to rely on the parachute and how to land. You know, parachutes, the kind of parachutes that they pack for pilots don't land you very softly on the ground. You know, you see these guys that jump the Golden Knights from the Army and so on and so forth, and they've got these big paracommander wing parachutes, you know, and they come in and they pull these cords and they just float down and just settle on their feet. Doesn't happen like that with a parachute that you put on your back. For a fighter pilot, you land, you have what's called a three-point landing. You land on your feet, your ankles, then you go to your knees, and then your thigh, and then your shoulder. So they talk about the 5 points, your feet, your ankles, your knees, your thighs, your shoulder. And you just roll when you land. Most of my landings were like threes, just right on my rear end, and that was it. You know, just feet never hit the ground, but they teach you how to do it properly because they don't want you to get injured. They want you to be able to continue to fly. They want you to be able to continue to, you know, to use the training that they've given you. And if you get injured, then that doesn't help the Air Force any because now they're out one pilot as well as an airplane. So airplanes can be replaced. Pilots are a little harder. So they put you through jump training, and then you finally get in the airplane. The interesting thing about getting into the airplane, the first airplane they put me in was called a T-37. It's a single-engine jet aircraft that has two side-by-side seats, and the instructor sits on the right and you sit on the left, and you're, you know, elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder as you're flying, and you can see what he's doing and he can see what you're doing, and it's a good thing he can see what you're doing because the first few times the things you're doing aren't the things you should be doing, and he's able to at least catch that. But the T-37 is an interesting airplane because it's made to spin, and it's made to sustain a spin. Any of you do any private flying at all, or ever done any? If you go out and fly in a commercial, a little Piper or a Cessna, they are made to not spin. And in fact, if you accidentally get into a spin and you just release all the controls, the airplane will get itself out of a spin. Because private pilots are not really supposed to be spinning aircraft, right? It's considered an abnormal activity. But in the Air Force, they want you to spin. They want you to learn how to get out of a spin. So this T-37 actually has what's called spin strakes on the front that actually hold it in a spin if it gets into a spin. So it won't get itself out, and you have to do it. So you get into the airplane, and you crank it up for the first time. You know, you've done your pre-flight, and you're real excited because you're finally going to get to fly. And, of course, your instructor pilot is going to be doing most of the flying anyway. And you've been in the simulator, and so you know how things are supposed to look. And you crank up the engines, and he takes off, and you're sitting there watching all this, and the first thing he's going to do is go up and teach you aerobatics. Because the first thing they want to find out is whether you can stand being upside down and in every other condition that's unnatural to man before they spend any more money on you. So they teach you aerobatics first. So the first few rides are extremely fun for some people and terrifying for other people. And every now and then you have a student who will wash out after the first three or four rides because he just can't take the aerobatics. But that's what flying's all about. I mean, I would just as soon fly upside down as fly right side up, which makes my wife very uncomfortable. But there are many times I've rented an Aero Club airplane when we've been living in Omaha or something, and we've gone up, and if it was an aerobatic airplane, I just can't help myself. I just have to do loops and rolls and everything else, and she just screams, but I can turn my intercom off, and that helps. But they teach you aerobatics. They want to find out how you're going to react in those stressful situations. And you know, it's interesting because aerobatics is probably a very good first introduction to stress in an airplane, because everything you're doing is unnatural. Everything you're doing is something new. Even if you like roller coasters, aerobatics is not like roller coasters. You know, roller coasters, you're always connected to something solid. Aerobatics, you're not. And you can do some really, really strange things and get some very strange sensations in aerobatics. But what you learn in aerobatics is not to trust yourself, not to trust your senses, because your senses very soon get scrambled. And in fact, one of the things that that they will teach you in the earliest rides is how to recover an airplane from an unusual situation. And the instructor pilot will say, okay, put your head down in your lap. Put your visor down, put your head down in your lap, and he will take the airplane, and he will do something totally unexpected. He will point the nose up and rev the engine so it sounds like you're going really fast when you're really slowing down, and he'll, you know, spin the airplane or something, or you know, do an aileron roll vertically or something, and say, okay, recover. And you lift your eyes, and your senses now are totally messed up. I mean, if you've ever been on a, you know those little merry-go-round things that the kids have that you grab on, they always made me sick. You know, you grab on and you spin around, and after you've been around two or three times and you try to do something, you get off, you know, you can't even walk straight. And it's that way in an airplane because your senses, your vestibular organ and your ears and so on, gets very messed up and you can't tell where you are. And so what you have to do is look outside and forget about your senses and go by what you see outside the airplane. What is the airspeed? Is it increasing? Is it decreasing? What is the engine speed? You know, where's the ground? Can I see it or can I not see it? So on and so forth. And then determine what your situation is and react to the situation without trusting your senses. You know, that's what Christian life is like. Because Proverbs 3 not only tells us that we're to trust the Lord with all of our hearts, it says, lean not to your own understanding. We have to do two things at the same time. We have to learn to trust Him, and we have to learn not to trust ourselves. Because, I mean, our nature is such that if we trust ourselves, we're going to do the wrong thing most of the time. So we have to not only not trust ourselves, but trust the Lord at the same time. And that's what airbags are all about. So it teaches you not to trust your own senses. It's an important lesson for us to learn in the Christian life as well. And then after they do the aerobatics, you go into spin training. And spin training is fun. For me, it was fun. See, my instructor pilot, the T-37, was a spin test pilot. So that was what he did all day long. He went up and did spins and found new ways to get out of them. So every lesson that you go up, you have a certain set of things you have to accomplish. But once you've accomplished those things, if you've got time and you've got fuel, you can pretty much go do what you want to do. So he and I would go up to about 25,000 feet and we'd spin. And we'd say, okay, let's try it upside down. Okay, let's try to see if we can get out this way. You know, we would spin in every direction and every attitude that we could and try different ways to get out of it.
Now, for some people, that's really scary.
For me, you know, I trusted him, so I knew, you know, he's a spin test pilot. If something goes wrong, he can always get us out of it. So I just enjoyed it. I had a great time. For one of my friends in pilot training, a guy named Willie Benton, it wasn't quite so fun. He went up for his first spin ride in the T-37, and the T-37 has a lap belt that has a lever on it. And it has a big thing that comes in. You put your two shoulder harnesses into it, and then you stick it into this buckle, and then you have this big lever that comes down, and that secures all of it together. That's what keeps you in the airplane. Well, part of the spin recovery procedure in the T-37 is to pop the stick forward so that your nose goes down so that you can make sure you're not spinning upside down. If you're spinning upside down, you pop the stick forward, you'll get into an erect spin. So his instructor pilot was demonstrating this the first time, and he said, so you're going to pop the stick forward. And as he popped the stick forward, the sleeve on his flight suit caught on that lever and undid the lever. And he lifted up out of the seat, and the airplane continued forward until it was now inverted, and he fell into the canopy, which was now pointing down. And Willie's all still strapped in, you know, and he's going, this is interesting, you know, and here's his instructor up here, and he's, you know, and he's spinning upside down. He thought, I hope this is what's supposed to happen. And fortunately, his instructor's intercom cable never disconnected, so he's screaming into the intercom and finally says to Willie, pull the stick back. So Willie grabs the stick, pulls it back, and of course the airplane goes like this, and now he falls out of the canopy back into his seat. He was upside down and finally got around and recovered the airplane, but it was not the first spin ride, not your first introduction you want to spinning. So Willie didn't like spins very well for some strange reason, but I loved them. But the thing it taught me was to rely on my instructor, because I knew that his skill set was such that I couldn't get into trouble that he couldn't get out of. And it's nice to know that in the Christian life, too, that there are times we're going to make mistakes and we're going to get ourselves in trouble. We're going to make the wrong decision. We're going to go down the wrong path. But we always have somebody who knows how to get us out of that, somebody who can help us recover. Somebody who knows all the ins and outs, all the elements of the situation, everything going on in the universe, and to him it's nothing for him to solve our problems for us. And we have to trust him to do that. And so that was a good lesson for me, both in that, in spin training, and also in the Christian life. And then comes the great day, once you've done your aerobatics and you've done your spins, when you're going to solo. Now, soloing in a private airplane like a Cessna or something is kind of goes like this. You know, you're taking a flight with your instructor. You've done two or three touch and goes, and he's sitting there beside you, and he'll say, okay, now pull over here. And then he'll open the door, and he'll get out. He'll say, go do two or three more, and then, you know, I'll meet you over in the FBO shop. And okay, so you go and do a few touch and goes. But in a jet, it's not like that, because your instructor meets you in the ops shack, and you go through the plan for the for the flight, but you know you're going to be by yourself on this flight. There's no surprise to it. And you know that the minute you walk out that door, he's not walking out the door with you. And so you're walking out to the jet, you're doing your own pre-flight, nobody else to check and see if you missed anything. That's another area of trust. You know, these airplanes are maintained by guys that you don't know. Each airplane has a crew chief. That crew chief is responsible for that aircraft, and he's responsible to make sure that everything works on it. And we often have fun with crew chiefs, and at the end of every flight, if we have any problems with the airplane, we write them up on a sheet, and then the crew chief has to fix the problem and write it up, and every now and then we'll have some fun communicating with the crew chiefs. There's some accounts of those that you can get on the internet. One of the guys wrote up on his squawk, the left main tire almost needs replacing, and the crew chief wrote back, almost replaced the right main the left main tire. You know, so you get to know the crew chiefs a little bit, and you know, you banter back and forth. But the fact of the matter is, you're about to take an airplane that you didn't fix, you didn't fuel it, you didn't check it the last time it came back in. I mean, somebody else is responsible for all that, and you're going to step into this airplane and fire up that jet engine, and you're going to scream off into the sky, trusting that the guy who took care of all that knew what he was doing. Another good example of trust, that you've got to trust that crew chief. So you get into the airplane for the first time solo, and you strap in, and you look beside you, and there's nobody there. And it's not a propeller you're starting up. This is a jet engine in the back. You're cranking up, and you're going to scream down the runway and take off. And you're not just going to take off and come back and land. You're going to take off, and you're going to go into the practice area, and you're going to do some aerobatics, and you're going to do some spins or whatever, you know, happens to be on that day's agenda for that flight. And then you're going to come back, and you're going to land. And so it's not a matter of, well, I just have to make three landings, and I'm okay. I mean, I have to go out there and put everything into practice that I've learned. And if I haven't learned my aerobatics right, or I haven't learned my spin training right, then I'm going to get myself in trouble. So there's a lot of training that you learn to trust. Things that you've learned along the way that you know, I know this material. I trust this material. And it's like that in the Christian life, because all the way through our Christian life as we're growing up, we learn the Word of God. Hopefully we memorize the Word of God. We learn what it means. We learn how it applies. And constantly we are being reminded of the fact that I have to trust those things that I've been taught. And even though my situation seems to be different, I have to trust the things that I've been taught and do it the way I was taught by the Scriptures to do it. And that way I know I'll be safe. That way I know the Lord is going to bless what I'm doing. If I take off on my own, I try it my own way, I may or may not be successful. But I know that if I follow the Lord's procedures, the things He's taught me, I'm going to be able to do the things that need to be done. As you go through, once you pass your solo, you've been flying for a while, you've got your aerobatics down and all that, and all of a sudden it comes time for instrument training. And instrument training, again, is one more thing you have to add to your repertoire of skills, because now you're going to be flying without looking outside the airplane. And they put a hood on you, and all you can see is the instrument panel, and the instructor pilot will tell you where you need to go and what altitude you need to be at. He'll put you through maneuvers that without any reference to what's going on outside. And you have to learn to trust your instruments. There's a lot of guys, a lot of pilots who've been killed over the years because they got into bad weather. They didn't know how to fly by instruments. And what happens is that if you're flying along and you think you're straight and level and your wing begins to bank, then that bank position becomes straight and level to you because you just stay in that bank long enough till your body says that's straight and level. That's the way I should be flying. And then you bank a little bit more, and then your body after a while says, that's straight and level. Well, your instruments are telling you it's not straight and level, but if you haven't learned to rely on your instruments, you learn to rely on your ears, and you end up flying in a spiral and killing yourself. And so learning instruments is another set of skills that we have to learn. And it's important because there are times you get into a cloud bank and you can't see the ground. You have no reference as to where you are. You can't see differences between light up and down. You can't see anything except your instruments. And your instruments will tell you exactly what you're doing if you trust them. And I think about the instruments that the Lord's put in our lives as Christians. He's put a number of things. He's put a conscience into us that we can trust. If we've not seared it, if we've not ignored it so long that that it doesn't work anymore, but if we've been diligent about living the Christian life, then our conscience should be an extremely sensitive instrument to us, and we should be listening to what the Lord is telling us through our conscience. Other people, other believers, are another instrument that God puts in our lives. A wise person goes and checks those other instruments, checks those other believers and what their opinions are. What do you think about this? You know, I'm considering this. What would your opinion be? You know, what would, from your spiritual experience and so on, how wise do you think this is? And checking those other instruments when we're about to step out into an unknown area is an important thing. Just like the instruments will tell you what you're doing in an airplane, there's a few things that will tell us about our own situation. Two in particular that I've found are very helpful to me in checking what I'm doing is, where am I spending my time and where am I spending my money? Because that's usually a pretty good indication of where my priorities are. And if they're being spent in the wrong area, then maybe I need to recheck my instruments. Maybe I need to reorient myself. Maybe I'm navigating in the wrong direction. Because the things that are precious to us are the things that we invest in. And we invest our time and we invest our finances. And sometimes that's a good way to find out if there's something that's displaced the Lord in our experience and in our lives. If we're focused somewhere else, and that's where we're expending all those resources that God's given to us. So checking your instruments is a big thing, not only in flying, but also in the Christian life. And then when you've learned to instrument fly, you get into a new phase called formation flying. Formation flying is an absolutely essential skill for a fighter pilot because you hardly ever go someplace by yourself. There's usually two or three or four airplanes going the same place, and so you're flying in formation. And the reason you fly in formation is because if you have to fly through the weather, you have no way of knowing where the other aircraft are unless you can see them. And the thicker the weather gets, the shorter the distance you can see. And so every fighter pilot is taught to fly as close to the other airplane as necessary to keep them in sight. And there have been times I've been flying through weather on a four-ship formation, and the only airplane I could see was the leader, and the only thing I could see was his wingtip light, and that's it. And I had to fly based on that reference in order to stay with him in the weather. Learning to fly in formation. Now, it's another matter of trust because you have to trust the leader to do what's right because whatever he does, you're going to do. When we changed from the F-105G to the F-4D at the Georgia Air National Guard, we thought, well, finally we have two engines. Yeah, how nice. We've been flying with one engine for so long, and the F-105 was a huge aircraft that only had one jet engine. And the F-4 had two. But then we found that just, 6 months into having the F-4, the security that we thought we had was short-lived because we lost our first air crew in about, 20 years, I guess, the 20-year history of the unit. Because we had a four-ship of airplanes that went down to Eglin Air Force Base to drop some bombs on the bombing range down there in Florida. They just come off a tanker. They just refueled. They drop down into the low-level structure because pilots have to learn how to fly at low level. That's how you're going to get under the enemy radar. And there was a four-ship. They dropped down to the low-level structure, so they were flying at about 150 feet maybe. And the leader went into a bank, and the guy who was on the inside of the bank, on the inside of the turn, was a guy named John Hammond. Had a guy in the back seat named Jim Stakely. And they drop down as they should have because as this airplane is turning, this airplane has to drop down to stay in fingertip formation. And the nearest they can figure is that John must have looked outside and thought he was closer to the ground than he should have been. And he rolled and pulled the airplane up, and those combined actions caused the airplane to depart from controlled flight. And it went out of control, and they both ejected. But by the time their seats left, the airplane was upside down, and they ejected right into the ground. And we lost both those guys. Turns out Jim Stakely was a believer. I have another story I'll tell you in a minute if we have time. But we lost those guys because of a lack of formation discipline. Because they didn't trust the leader. They thought, he must be taking me into a bad situation. I need to do something on my own. And isn't that the way it is sometimes when we follow the Lord? He leads us in a place and we go, I'm not comfortable here. I mean, I don't know why he's got me here. This isn't, you know, what I'm used to doing, and this I don't think I'm qualified to do this, or whatever the case might be. And so we decide we better do something on our own. And that's when we get ourselves in trouble. Because the Lord will never lead us into a place that he won't supply everything we need, even the ability and the skills and, all the resources. But John, his call sign was Hambone. You just call him Hambone. But he must have thought, this leader isn't trustworthy right now. A similar thing happened not too long ago with the Blue Angels. Or no, it was the Thunderbirds, Air Force flight team. A few years ago, they were practicing out of the desert, and the leader misjudged a loop and got too low, and all four of the airplanes impacted the ground in perfect formation because the leader didn't do what he was supposed to do. Everybody else has to trust the leader. I do remember there was a time coming in from Eglin Air Force Base. I was following a guy named Clark Bergren. He was in the number one airplane. I was the number two airplane. It was just the two of us. And we were flying along the coast, the Gulf Coast of Florida, getting ready to turn north and go back to Atlanta. And we were in fingertip formation. I was kind of loose, about maybe three or four ships away from him. And I just had this feeling, I need to move on to the other side. And so I just dipped under and had the... That was something I was able to do, was allowed to do. So I just dipped under, crossed over to the other side. And as soon as I was passing underneath Clark, he yelled into his intercom, "Woodstock, look to the left, look out." And I turned to, and looked, and there was a light aircraft right where I had been. Just passed. I bet that's probably the last time that pilot ever flew. Because to have two F-105s go screaming past you at just under Mach 1 that close would have been a very terrifying experience for him, I'm sure. But the Lord watches out for us. The Lord watches out for us. It's real simple. We just trust Him and we follow His lead. So we learn formation. And then, of course, we learn navigation. And again, there are times in the Christian life where the Lord is going to lead us into areas where we don't think we're ready to go. But we still have to follow. And just one more story. Our time's about gone. I told you about Jim Stakely. Jim and I used to fly periodically. We didn't have a set crew. They would schedule us based on who was available. And we took off one time in a two-ship. A guy named Bruce McLean was flying the lead ship, and we were number two. We'd gone out to an aerial combat area, and we'd done air-to-air combat for about 45 minutes or so until our fuel was depleted. And then as we came back into Dobbins Air Force Base, we hit some weather. And we got diverted, and we got moved around, and finally got back onto the ground control approach radar, and we were both really low on fuel. And so we started an approach, ground control approach radar means there's a guy on the ground looking at you on radar telling you how to make turns and go up and down and left and right to get onto the runway. And this guy did a really, really poor job of it. And so when we broke out of the clouds, we were in no position to land. The runway was way over here, and we were over here, and so we executed a missed approach, and we came around to do it again. Well, our fuel was getting lower all the time. We came back in, and the guy got the guy on the radio again, and then this time about halfway down the approach path, his radio went out. And that hardly ever happens. But the procedure is if you don't hear from that ground control approach radar person for 5 seconds, you automatically execute a missed approach. So we executed another missed approach. Only this time, as we're pulling out and we're basically over the runway, I said, "Bruce, I don't have enough fuel for another approach." And we were in the clouds. We were at about 1,000 feet over the runway. And I said, "I do not have enough fuel for another approach. I'm going to roll out and I'm going to, you know, do a circling approach." Well, circling approaches you do with reference to the ground. Well, we couldn't see the ground. But Bruce said, "Okay, I'm going to go out for another approach. Do what you need to do." And so I said to Jim in the back seat, I said, "Jim, we're just going to have to trust the Lord for this one." He said, "Just do what the Lord tells you to do." So we rolled out on a heading on the runway, and then we turned and came back to a reciprocal heading. And when you're landing a fighter, it's not like a light aircraft where you have a downwind leg and then you turn to a base leg and then you turn to land. You actually have you fly at about 1,000 feet over the runway, displaced just about, oh, I don't know, a few hundred feet, and then you reach a point where your aircraft is level with the end of the runway, a point we call the perch, and you start a descending turn and you land, and it's all one action down until you land on the runway. But of course, normally you can see the runway. Well, this time we couldn't. And as we turned to fly parallel to the runway, Jim said, "Woodstock, look off the right wing." And I looked, and here was this balloon. You ever seen these balloons they tether at like gas stations when they're having a sale or something? And it was right off our wing. And I thought, gee, that's kind of interesting. Never seen that before. But it was the only thing we could see in the soup was this balloon go by. But anyway, we're flying along, and we got to the point that, to me, it was just the Lord saying, this is the perch, this is where you need to turn. And I couldn't see anything on the ground. And I said, "Jim, I think this is it. I'm going to make the landing." He said, "Go ahead." And so I cut the engine, threw the gear down and the flaps, and we started down, and just one turn all the way down, broke out at about 100 feet off the runway, and the runway was right there. And we landed. And it was the Lord. That's all it was. But it was trusting the Lord. And then I had to do that many times in flying, that something would happen absolutely outside my control. And the only thing I could do was trust the Lord. There's a mechanism, and I'll stop with this. There's a mechanism on the F-105 that checks the flap positions. And if the flaps get more than 8 degrees out of phase, it locks them in place, because the engineers felt that if the flaps got more than 8 degrees out of phase with one another, the airplane would become uncontrollable. Well, I took off from Dobbins one time, and I was just about 100 feet off the ground, threw the gear up, threw the flap handle up, and the left flap bracket broke, and the left flap streamlined immediately. And the right, and of course, the system in the airplane said the flaps are more than 8 degrees out of phase, so it locked the right one down. So I had one flap all the way up and one flap all the way down, and before I knew what was happening, I was doing aileron or flap rolls basically over the runway at 100 feet. And so I managed to pull the airplane out of that and declared an emergency and so on. But here's an airplane that theoretically is uncontrollable and unflyable. And I said, Lord, this is you. You've got to do this, because, you know, the airplane's not supposed to be able to do this. And to make a long story short, went out, got looked over, came back in, landed the airplane, had to take the barrier at the end of the runway because the airplane was so heavy and we were so fast in landing. But the Lord worked it all out and just walked away from many situations that in any reasonable fashion I should never have been able to walk away from. All a matter of trusting the Lord. And the Christian life is just that way. We trust the Lord. And the minute we stop trusting the Lord and trusting ourselves, we're going to get ourselves into trouble. But if we're able to trust the Lord even when everything seems impossible, He's the God of the impossible. That's when He really starts to work. And it's just so encouraging to get your faith built when you see the Lord do something that you didn't think He would ever be able to do or He would ever do for you. And He does it for you. So the message is simple. Trust. Just as Joe was saying in his devotional, we have to trust the Lord. You know, whatever our situation is, most of us may not be as dramatic as flying a fighter, but in everyday life, we run up into things that we have to trust the Lord for. So I trust that it's a lesson you're learning. And if you haven't yet, by all means, start now, because you'll see the Lord do some amazing things. Charlie, would you close in prayer for us, please?
Dear Father, we thank you that we can trust you. You are the God, the Creator, that called us, promised us eternal life, promised us that life here, no circumstance is going to hit us outside of your purview. So, Father, we plan to trust you, and I pray that you would give us a fixed heart and mind that would allow us in the midst of the circumstances to see your faithful hand in control. Amen.
Amen. Thank you.